Support for this episode of the podcast comes from our patrons at Patreon. Head to patreon.com/chasingearhart to join the chase and become a patron today. This episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast contains detailed plot spoilers for the novel The Last Grand Adventure by project guest Rebecca Behrens. If you have not read The Last Grand Adventure, or if you intend to read it, please pause this podcast and come back after you've read it. Listener discretion is advised. On the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 80 years later, all over the world, lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to the Chasing Earhart podcast. My grandmother pulled a small brown leather valise, a little weathered, out of the closet and carried it back to the armchair. Her hands trembled as she snapped open the clasp. She pulled out a packet of letters, some old and yellowed, others at the top of the pile looking crisper, fresh. She held the letters with both hands, pressing the packet to her chest, like she was giving it a tender hug. "Are those letters from..." I trailed off, realizing that I only knew of my late grandfather as my pop, the way my dad always referred to him. He died before I was born. "Mealy," my grandmother finished, a hint of a smile curling up her lips. It was the first one I'd seen from her all day. My sister. On episode 34 of the Chasing Earhart podcast, and on the eve of her novel's release, Rebecca Behrens joins us via Zoom to discuss The Last Grand Adventure and why she believes Amelia Earhart is a great fit for young adult novels. With me now, joining me via Zoom, is someone I'm very excited to speak with. Her name is Rebecca Behrens. She's an author. She has a book coming out called The Last Grand Adventure. It's actually coming out on March 20th, 10 days from the point that we're recording this, 2 days from the point that we're going to release this worldwide. Rebecca, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to be a Chasing Earhart guest. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
So let's start this conversation off with the same question I ask everybody. Can you tell everybody out there a little bit about your education and your professional background, please?
Sure. I have been a textbook editor for about a decade before I started publishing novels for middle grade readers, which for those who aren't familiar with the children's publishing lingo, that would be maybe ages 8 and up, 8 to 14 is the target audience. And I've always been a big history fan. It wasn't something that I studied in college. In college, I majored in psychology and Spanish, but history has been a passion since childhood. So when I started writing fiction for young readers, I really was compelled to write stories that relate to in some way to history. Either there's a historical fiction element of the story, or there's history is something that the characters are interacting with.
So I want to ask you, for someone who's, and we'll, of course we'll dive into the book in just a few moments here, but I want to ask you, for someone who is a fan of history and who is sort of wants to incorporate that into your writing, what is your earliest recollections or your earliest memories of Amelia Earhart in particular?
I think I remember reading books about her as a kid in elementary school. And I was so fascinated by her disappearance and the mystery of that. And, you know, I have vague memories as a kid of every now and then a news story coming out where there was a new clue or something that was supposed to finally show us what had happened to her on that last flight. And, you know, being very excited to hear about it and then disappointed that there was never a real solid answer. So that mystery fascinated me and kind of gnawed at me for years. And it's only been later, now that I've, you know, researched her life to write this book, that I kind of realized that the things that she accomplished that we know about, what is not a mystery in her life, is more interesting in a lot of ways than the mystery.
So let's get into it, because this is what we really wanted to talk about. The Last Grand Adventure. I was fortunate enough to receive an advanced copy, and I read it a couple of days ago. I immediately fell in love with the characters and the way you wrote the characters, and of course, you know, the story itself and sort of what happens and how it's built. Can you sort of talk to folks out there about sort of the inspiration for the story? How did this story come to you? What was the foundation? How did this come about?
So I'd always been interested in Amelia Earhart, in her disappearance. And I'm also someone who has at points in my life been a very nervous flyer. And I think that is part of the reason why I'm so fascinated by her as a historical figure, in that she did all these groundbreaking things in aviation at a time when it was a lot less safe than it is now. So someone who sometimes is nervous boarding a flight from New York to Chicago. I found it really fascinating to think about being the first woman to fly across the Atlantic Ocean, or the first person to fly from Honolulu to Oakland. And that she did that, and up against the sort of the gender restrictions at the time and also the safety issue. I found that really inspiring. But in terms of writing this book, I knew I wanted to write about Amelia Earhart. And for a long time, I liked the idea. There's a theory that I think was mostly debunked a few decades ago, that she had returned to the US and lived under a secret identity in New Jersey. And I thought it would be really interesting to write a story, to write fiction about a girl who figures out that her grandmother is actually Amelia Earhart. So that was the direction that I thought I was going to go in when I started researching her life. And as I started to read about her, and I discovered a book by her sister, Muriel Earhart Morrissey, Courage is the Price, which was published in the 1960s. And I read that biography, and I hadn't known before that Amelia Earhart had a younger sister, and that they had a very close relationship, but like a lot of sister relationships, there was, the usual sibling rivalry and tension there as well. And all of a sudden I realized that an equally interesting story to tell would be about how her disappearance affected her sister through the rest of her life. And so that kind of inspired me to create this character, Pidge, in the book, who is, very closely based on the real Muriel Earhart Morrissey, but is a fictional creation in the story itself. I have a really close relationship with both of my grandmothers, who are still in their 90s and still out there being bold and interesting women. So I liked the idea of setting up a book that's an adventure that is shared between a young girl and her grandmother. And that was where the idea to bring in the child character being Pidge's granddaughter. And they're going on this trip to try and find Amelia Earhart and figure out what happened to her.
Now, you just mentioned, you talked about Muriel Earhart and the guest, the actual podcast. We're getting ready to release episode 32 of the show today, later tonight. And the guest on that show happens to be Amy Kleppner, who is Muriel's daughter.
Wow.
Just sort of a heads up for you, I told her about your book and she's very interested in reading it. So I'd like to send her a copy of your book, because it's really kind of an interesting and really beautiful take on not only Amelia, her Aunt Amelia, but her mother, I think, is really sort of what you've done is really special. And I think we're going to start getting into light spoilers here in just a few moments before we go kind of full tilt on the spoilers. But I guess the first thing I want to ask you is, why did you want to create the character of Bee, basically, who's really the star of the show? I mean, it's Bee and Pidge, but I mean, Bee is sort of like the POV character for the reader to kind of identify with and latch onto. What kind of creative liberties did you take in creating Bee? Is she based off anyone that you knew or that you know? Tell everybody about that.
Sure. Bee is pretty much a wholly fictional creation. I think in the book, I was trying to be mindful of the fact that Muriel is, a real historical figure, and she was married and had children, and they don't appear in the book. So Bee's parents is sort of left a little fuzzy. I don't think even her last name is necessarily mentioned at any point, which I did sort of to kind of separate the actual facts from the fiction. But Bee is just she's a fictional character, and she's, I think writers, even when you're not writing about your own experiences, your own life, sometimes a part of yourself comes into a character. And I think something that Bee and I share is that she begins the book not necessarily thinking an adventure is the kind of thing she wants to take on. She's a little uncertain. She has some anxiety about spending the summer with her grandmother she doesn't know well, and about the things that they're going to do on this adventure to find Amelia Earhart. But she's a very curious person. That's the kind of character that I would have wanted to read about when I was 8 to 14 years old. because that would have resembled me. I was someone who I loved adventures on the page, reading and writing, but in real life I was a little more uncertain and a little bit of a nervous traveler. So that kind of inspired the character of Bea. I thought also it would be in kind of an interesting contrast to Amelia Earhart's, who we, you know and love because of her bravery and the things that she accomplished and just for being so daring, to have the other characters be a bit of a foil for her, where they're maybe not natural adventurers. And, you know, Bea gets thrown into this planes, trains, and automobiles journey with her grandmother, and she kind of has to come into her own in terms of, you know, taking on challenges and realizing that she wants to live a little.
So we're going to get into it a little bit here. So for folks who are listening, I think up to this point, we haven't really gotten in any spoiler territory yet. So it's pretty safe for the first 10 minutes or so of this conversation. But now we're going to get into a little bit of light spoilers before we go, as I said earlier, before we go full tilt into some of the more heavy spoilers in the book. So let's do this. Let's just go ahead and let's give everybody the plot of The Last Grand Adventure and let's get into it.
So this is the story of Bea, who is 12 years old. It's set in the summer of 1967. And she goes down to sort of meet her grandmother, an estranged grandmother, Pidge, who she hasn't spent a lot of time with so far in her life. And she plans to spend just a couple of weeks with Pidge at her new retirement community, helping her settle in. But shortly after she arrives, Pidge explains to her that she has a plan to travel by train from Los Angeles back to Atchison, Kansas, to be reunited with her long-lost sister, who is Amelia Earhart. And the reason why she believes that they're going to be successful in this is because since Amelia disappeared in the book, it's 30 years ago, she's received a series of kind of mysterious letters that are written in her sister's handwriting and that have, they're sprinkled with the kind of shared details that only a sister would know. So she's very confident that these letters are coming from Amelia and that they're secretive and they're promising that if Pidge can just hold on a little longer, they're finally going to be reunited and the truth of what happened to Amelia will come out. So Bea and Pidge take off. They share a ride with one of Amelia's old flight instructors, Anita Netta Snooky Snook, to the train station. They travel by train until they are kicked off because it turns out that they've been train hopping. They sneaked on board and they end up getting kicked off the train in New Mexico, where they hitchhike to a bus stop, where they take a bus to, I believe it's Salina, Kansas, where they manage to talk their way into a flight with a fellow Amelia Earhart enthusiast to get the rest of the way to Atchison. And they're trying to do all of this before July 24th. Which would be Amelia's birthday when she's promised to meet. So in the end, they do finally make it back to Kansas. And this is where a real spoiler comes in. It's not the reunion that they expect at the end. There isn't a true resolution in the book other than some very compelling clues that suggest that Amelia may have been there or somehow their journey was not in vain.
Okay, so I love how you incorporated Anita Snook into it, and how you called her Snooky and everything. That was really. I mean, it's one of those things where it's just a kind of a really nice touch. What was your research? We'll kind of backtrack a little bit, but what was your research going into this project when it comes to real world people that were connected to Amelia Earhart in some way, shape, or form, whether it's her career, whether it's her personal life? How did you kind of take that creative liberty and incorporate those folks into the story?
I started by reading several really great biographies of Amelia Earhart, and that was kind of, you know, my baseline to figure out where I needed to look for other information. In doing that, I uncovered, you know, that she had been instructed by Anita Snook. And from there, I went looking for more information about her life, and I like to look for primary sources when possible. So I managed to find, I think it was through something called the Gilder Lehrman Institute, which is an American history institute, some primary sources. So like letters and pictures of the two. I also found some, I believe the 99s has some information about Netta Snook on their website. Library of Congress is another place that I look for, you know, old articles, old photographs. Sometimes there's even video of people. I wanted to make sure that I included other female aviators, or at least mention them in the book. And, you know, with any process when you're writing historical fiction, I think in the first draft, I had double the letters from Amelia's point of view, and probably double the facts relating to her life and relating to other women in aviation. And, you know, as I worked with my editor, because it's fiction, you have to pare some of that down. It's really easy when you're writing and you're very enthusiastic to sort of overload a book with facts. And some of them have to come out because you're telling a story first and foremost, and you want to entertain the reader and not bring them out of the world of the fictional narrative with like a little too much information. But I, you know, I definitely wanted to make sure that Netta Snook was still a prominent character in the story. And I wanted to give her a scene too, just because I liked the idea of having another female aviator who could be like a character who's not just told through flashbacks, who gets to be in a scene with the others.
And, you know, it's there's a term in filmmaking, you've probably heard it, it's you know, the term is called Chekhov's gun, basically. And it's like the point of view piece that, you know, sort of drives the characters in the film to kind of get to where they want, or something that they're after. In this case, I like to call these Chekhov's letters, because this is really sort of the letters that drives Pidge all these years to want to find her sister and to want to, you know, make this trip and go home to Atchison, Kansas. Can you talk a little bit about kind of structuring those letters in particular? Because they do play a large, they play a significant role in the actual story. Talk about structuring those letters and how you work that process out, writing sort of in Amelia's hand and writing in her train of thought.
Yeah, that's a great question. I wrote the letters entirely separately from the rest of the book. And I think I did, in this case, I wrote the story first, the main narrative. And then I went back after I'd done that and I wrote the letters. I believe there were 10 of them in the initial first draft, using my notes from the research that I'd done, you know, things I flagged that related to something in the story so they would be really well incorporated, or just things about Amelia's life that were too important not to share, or that I personally found too interesting not to share. And initially I told her story mostly chronologically through the letters, and that was kind of to help myself organize it. And, you know, I realized later on that in the way that they would work best with the rest of the book, the 1967 narrative, might not be a chronological telling. So then I kind of started the editing process where I was moving things around and shaking things up and figuring out more like thematically how they would work best being organized with the rest of the story, not necessarily in the order of her life. But I wanted the letters to give a little bit of a biography for readers who might not know a lot about Amelia's life and accomplishments. And that was a bit tricky because she is writing letters to a sister who would know all of these things, who would have lived through them with her. So there's kind of the question of like, well, why is she retelling them? Which I think the book kind of explains with the mystery of the letters. But also I kind of use the frame of her reminiscing to her sister and the things that she wished she would have said and the details of their shared life that, you know, she found the most important now that she'd been away for a while.
I want to ask you about a character. And again, we're going into towards the ending a little bit of the book. So if you're okay with everything we've spoken about so far and you're listening to the show and you don't want to have the ending given away, stop the recording now and read the book and then come back to discuss this with us, or to listen to this discussion rather. I'm reading about this character, the character of Viola, at the end of the book. And I'm wondering, as I'm reading this, I'm wondering, was there ever any thought of you making Viola Amelia?
I love this question, and I have kind of a great story with it. That had never occurred to me until before the book was published. I think before it even went to copy edits, an author friend read it to give a blurb, or, you know, a selling quote, basically. As soon as she finished it, she emailed me and said, "It's Viola, right? She's still hiding her identity. Viola is Amelia." And, you know, she had this whole theory and she was just convinced. And, you know, in her email, she said, "I just need to know that it's her and she was really there." And I mean, it was kind of a shock to me at the time, because writing that, just that element had not really occurred to me. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, wow, like that's a completely valid way to read the story and interpret it. And I kind of love that interpretation. I did, when I was writing, I wanted to make it a little unclear, especially the scene where they first get to the house and open the door. And it, there's kind of a cliffhanger at the end of the chapter where you don't know until you turn to the next one, is it Amelia? So I wanted that to be a little, the reader isn't sure. And in my point of view as the author writing the story, no, she's not. But I love that some readers think that she is. And I think the clues are there to support it, even if that wasn't the interpretation I initially went with.
I was bought and sold when I was reading it. I was sitting here like, oh my God, I'm reading. I was like, Viola is Earhart. Earhart is Viola. Like, that's it. That's going to be the big revelation. And then obviously it doesn't turn out the way that I was thinking, but it's, you know, that, I guess my next question is, did you ever give any other thought to, I'm assuming you did, because most folks do when they write books and movies and things, but as to what you wanted the ending to be, how did you want, before we get into how it ends, and sort of the interpretation of that, did you ever give any thought to multiple endings and like how, you know, what was your kind of viewpoint on how you wanted this thing to end? Was it ever going to end differently than what it actually ended up ending as?
Yeah. I did have really a very strong desire to make the ending ambiguous. And I wanted readers to be able to draw their own conclusion and kind of like almost like a Rorschach test, like whatever they want the truth to be, there would be something in the ending that would kind of support it for them. And that was partly because I'd written another novel for middle grade readers about the lost colony of Roanoke. And in that experience, I learned that when you're dealing with a history mystery, there's kind of pressure to solve it. And that's really hard and almost unsatisfying when like the historical record does not have an answer for you. So I knew that I wanted to make this ending a little ambiguous. When I was first writing the book, and this is getting a little bit into spoiler territory, I kind of pictured that the letters were almost a magical thing, that they were real. And they were written by Amelia, but Amelia was never going to appear at the end, that they had somehow appeared for Pidge without explanation, and almost like a magical realism element. And as I was writing the book, I realized, wow, like that is both really hard to pull off and also I think pretty unsatisfying for a reader, especially a middle grade reader who's going to want a little more clarity at the end and some resolution. So I've left some kind of, you know, clues that it's totally, I completely like the theory that Amelia is Viola. And it's funny how when you write a book and after it's published and people read it, it kind of stops being yours as the author and it becomes a shared thing. And now that, you know, people have had that reaction to it, I'm like, well, I'm really happy that that's there. And I like to go back and sort of, you know, have that have been my idea to make a real strong resolution for that. But it's nice how a book becomes less of a solitary thing and more of like a shared communal reading experience. But I wanted there to be some clues that perhaps Pidge could have created the letters herself. You know, she repeats some of the phrases from them throughout the book that, you know, Bee hears her say things and thinks that they sound familiar, and she's not sure if it's something that her grandmother has said before, or something she's read in the letters. And I think there's a final scene where they're by the river, and, you know, Pidge almost admits that she knows that they're not real. And there's kind of a suggestion of like, well, then where did they come from? And were they something? Was this kind of like a form of writing therapy for her? And we don't know. But, you know, I wanted to leave it at the end so I haven't solved the mystery for readers, because it's not solved in real life. But there's enough there that they can kind of pull a satisfying conclusion from the details in the story.
Were you ever tempted to just wrap this thing up in a nice bow and have Amelia appear and have that happen, you know, as a happy ending for Pidge and for Bee, and to have that kind of finality kind of tie up?
Yeah. I mean, I thought about that. And I mean, partly I wanted to do that for the characters, because as you spend time with them on the page, you know, you really want them to get a happy ending. And I also loved the idea of, you know, having a narrative in which Amelia did make it, in which she made it back and she did that round the world flight, and she hasn't disappeared. But ultimately, I kind of felt that art, you know, artistically and in terms of the tone of the book, a resolution that's a little more murky just seemed to fit a little better.
Let's talk about, I know you've alluded to it, we're full into spoiler territory now. I'm hoping whoever's listening at this point has already read the book or will have bought the book or stopped the recording. So we're just going to go for it here. But, you know, I want to ask you about that ending, and you've kind of alluded to it already, and kind of that Pidge wrote the letters herself as a form of some kind of a therapy that she just maybe wasn't able to sort of mentally project for whatever reason. But I want to talk about that last sort of scene, you know, in the book, the one that you talk about where they're standing on the embankment of the, you know, the Missouri River. I live, you know, we happen to live three blocks from that spot. We've stood on that embankment. We've been in that house. We shoot a lot of our documentary in that house and everything. I think for us, and you know, that corner of Terrace and Santa Fe and everything, and everything you sort of so eloquently describe in the book, I think Atchison itself is sort of a character towards the very end, yeah, because you have that spot. Can you sort of talk a little bit about kind of setting it, that last, not the last, you know, scene in the book, but one of the last scenes, the definitive last scene on that spot in that area? It's that's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. You know, I wanted the end of this book to be a homecoming. And even if it's not a homecoming where Amelia returns and the sisters are physically reunited, I wanted it to be a homecoming for both Bee and Pidge. And for Pidge, it's going back to this place that has so much meaning to her in her life, especially in her relationship with her sister, a place that she truly considers her home and that she feels very fondly about. And I wanted her to get to return there with her family, being reunited with the characters of her son and her granddaughter, Bee. For Bee, kind of the same. Bee is a character who's struggling a little bit with the changes in her family. And, you know, through this journey, she's kind of realized that, you know, what she thought of as home being just a physical place with a certain group of people in it, she could kind of expand that idea. And so at the end, where they're all together there in Atchison, it's home for all of them. And I liked the idea of it being the place where Amelia was born. And, you know, just this, you know, kind of bucolic town where they have family history and where they could just experience something really special at that last moment. Even if Amelia wasn't with them, she was there in spirit. And I know that Amelia Earhart is a very important figure to the town of Atchison. So it seemed like her spirit would be there, would be happy there. It was a true place that could be sort of a, you know, it's her birthplace. So it would be like a good place to have home at the end.
And I want to talk about the symbolism of them standing on that embankment on the Missouri River and Pidge holding that letter in her hand and wanting it to be so real. And you have, you know, the rain coming down and she asks Bee to, you know, to soar with her and Amelia one more time, or fly with her and Amelia one more time. And she's, you know, basically says that line. It was, you know, I loved having you as a sister. And she lets that letter go. You know, I think it's, can you talk a little bit about that symbolism and kind of what that meant to the character of Pidge and really what that meant to the character of Bee really as well?
Yeah. You know, I think for Pidge, the character in this book, she had hung on for a really long time to a hope that they would be reunited, you know, physically and literally. And she's realizing at that point that, you know, they're not, but in letting go of the hope that she was clinging to, I think it almost frees her up to have a relationship with her sister that's based on her memories and the shared experiences that live on. So it was, you know, kind of a freeing moment. And, you know, it made sense for her that it would be in the place that they had shared so much. You know, I think that she needed to go back to a place where she really felt her sister in order to say goodbye and to move on from that. And, you know, also the fact that over the course of the novel, she goes, at the beginning, Bee and Pidge don't know each other well. And I don't know that they even particularly like each other very much at the beginning. By the time that they get to that point, they've become very close and they've shared a lot. And of course, nothing will ever replace her sister to Pidge, but now she has this wonderful relationship with her granddaughter where they're sharing adventures and they're sharing their family history. And, you know, I think for her, that was something that almost made it easier to move on finally.
Rebecca, what is, you're really kind of in a good position to answer this question, because, you know, you have this book that's coming out in 2 days from the point of the release of this episode. What is the impact and legacy of Amelia Earhart and why is she so relevant? Why does she drive, you know, authors like you, you know, 81 years going on 81 years after she disappeared to write, you know, books like this about her in a young adult fictional sense, and of course in a biographical sense and all that other stuff? why does she matter so much still to the world 81 years after she's disappeared?
It's amazing to me that, you know, this week even in the, or the, while we're recording this week, in the news, there was, you know, a new article about they were looking into the forensic evidence again and now think that the bones that were found in Gardner Island may in fact have been hers. And what fascinated me about that is that it's been 8 decades and that, you know, the public interest is still there and so strong. Before I started working on this book, when I had the concept, but I hadn't really started writing, I was doing a writing workshop with a bunch of 9 to 11-year-old kids. And I asked them all to write a short story about any historical figure they wanted. And I think at least a third of them were Amelia Earhart stories. And I love that the interest is still there. I think it's, you know, she was an incredibly charismatic person. She was smart. She was well-spoken. She was funny. She was beautiful. And she did amazing things. And I think especially now, you know, there's kind of a movement right now in the country to look really strongly at the accomplishments of women. And I think she's someone who, even at a time where maybe people weren't there and weren't trying to see, you know, women who could be heroes, she was filling that role. She was kind of on the vanguard. You know, I know one of the things that she said, I believe, to the students at Purdue University when she was there, she really encouraged women to dare to live, was her quote. There's kind of a bittersweet symmetry almost in the fact that that's really her motto. That's really what she was inspiring people to do, is to dare to live. And yet in doing so, she disappeared. And, you know, we don't know what happened to her fate, which just the kind of the convergence of those two things, that she had so much life and she accomplished so much, yet there's this fascinating mystery of what happened to her. It's really a unique figure.
Yeah. And, you know, what I, one of the things I wanted to point out too for folks who are going to be picking up the book, and especially for the audience that it's intended for, you actually have a set of questions that it's like a post-read discussion questions list that you have on your website. And we'd like to include that in the show notes so people can actually link to this and discuss this book at length after they've done reading it, or as they're reading it, maybe. Can you talk a little bit about kind of developing those questions and kind of that process? Because I know you do a lot of talks with young kids and everything about your books, not only this one, but previous books you've written. How important is that discussion after the book to kind of see what their interpretation is of different aspects of what you wrote?
I think it's really important. One of my favorite things, I'm a huge reader, obviously, and my mother was an English teacher. So, you know, growing up, I read a lot, and there was a lot of discussion about books in our house. And, you know, especially with this story with a bit of ambiguity at the end, you know, I think there's a lot of room for discussion in it. So I was really hoping that this would be the kind of story that after people read it, they would, you know, want to find someone else who'd read the book and talk to them about it. And, well, what do you think happened? And what do you think was the meaning of this? And because there's a lot of history sprinkled in it, and there is also, you know, a fair amount of symbolism in some of the scenes, you know, I think there's a lot there that people can, you know, you could read the book just on a purely literal level, or you could kind of read in and, you know, stop and kind of think about the history or some of the themes. Before I started, you know, writing mostly full time, I was a textbook editor. So I worked on reading textbooks for grades kindergarten through 6th grade. So I'm very familiar with writing discussion questions for other books. And so that is something, probably because of that work history. After I finished writing one of my own books, I kind of enjoy going back through and figuring out what I would ask if I were writing a lesson on this. Strangely enough, that's not something I think about when I'm actually actively writing the book. It always comes afterwards. And I think a lot of writers do this. You can kind of shut off certain parts of your brain when you're in a different stage of the process. You know, in a draft, you try and not self-edit. And, you know, when you're editing, you try to not go in and, you know, pick too much in terms of a first drafting sense. So I tend to turn off my textbook editor part of my brain when I'm working on a book until it's through copy edits.
So the book comes out in 2 days. It's going to be released on the 20th worldwide. That's 2 days from this recording. Rebecca, tell everybody where they can pick the book up. Tell everybody where they can find your work online, where they can follow you on social media. Please plug away. We want to get this book out there.
Yeah, the book should be available at all independent bookstores or the major retailers like Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Amazon. I love independent bookstores. They are wonderful places that support literacy in communities. So if there is an independent bookstore in your area, I encourage you to go there to pick up a copy. If they don't have it, they can order it for you. And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram. It would be at Rebecca Behrens on Twitter, at Rebecca Behrens Books on Instagram. I also have a Facebook author page, which is easily searchable. And my website is RebeccaBehrens.com. And there are a bunch of resources about the book on the website. Some links to articles that I enjoyed, a few pictures from the Amelia Earhart Birthplace Museum in Atchison, Kansas, and some discussion guides.
And we'll list all that on the show notes so people can follow along and get everything they can out of this book. It's a wonderful story, The Last Grand Adventure. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us on the Chasing Earhart podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Chris Williamson, and you've been listening to the Chasing Earhart podcast. You can follow the project on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook using the handle at Chasing Earhart. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Join us next week when we sit down with project guest and Amelia Earhart presentation expert, Rob Ellis. Thanks for listening.